The Women's World Cup has been going on for 3 days, and the big moments from the weekend have been replaying on every news station all morning long. Just kidding. The only moment from a Women's World Cup that's ever gotten constant replay on every news network is the moment when Brandi Chastain scored the penalty kick that won the whole thing in 1999. And there is a pretty good chance that that is because she ripped her shirt off. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about women's soccer on KCUR's Central Standard. Gemma Clark is the author of Soccer Women, the icons, rebels, stars, and trailblazers who transformed the beautiful game. She's with us now. Hi, Gemma.
Hi, Gina.
Women's soccer has come a long way since it began, and that's because of the powerful women whose stories you tell in your book. But can you share some of the, I guess you'd call them, indignities that women in soccer used to contend with?
Well, I think used to contend with is a bit optimistic. I think they're still contending with them. Just one example springs to mind, and that's Tiffany Milbrett. Was nominated for the first ever FIFA Women's Footballer of the Year Award, Soccer Player of the Year Award, back in 2001. And she was nominated alongside Mia Hamm and Sun Wen, two of the greatest players of the day and of all time. And so there were three male players on the stage, three female players on the stage, and she said every single journalist in the room was directing questions at the male players. So it was David Beckham and Raul and Luis Figo. And eventually the FIFA moderator kind of said, well, you know, can somebody ask one of the women a question? And she said there was this long silence. And then all of a sudden, one of the male journalists put up his hand and said, so who do you think is going to win the men's award?
Oh, my God.
And, you know, when she was telling me that story, I thought, well, thank goodness. I feel as though now there have been so many awards, like we're coming a long way. And then last year, there was the debacle. A player called Ada Hegenberg, if you don't know, is kind of the best player in the world. She plays for Norway, although she doesn't play for Norway at the moment because she's on a quite prominent strike against inequality. She won the inaugural Ballon d'Or, which is the most prestigious soccer playing award in the world. And the DJ who was, you know, playing music at the time that she won the award asked her to twerk on stage, just really taking away from the moment and really kind of degrading her in front of the crowd when she just won this incredible award. So I think there's just such a long way to go. And every time you think that you know, the women's players are making a step forward, it just seems as though there's also then a step backwards somehow.
Well, let's then separate this into two parts, the transformation that has already occurred, and then we'll get into what still needs to change. So can we start with where we began to where we are now? How would you describe that piece of the journey? And then we'll imagine a future journey.
Yes, I think what's fascinating is just how important and integral soccer has been to the struggle for women's rights and equality, really from the very beginning. The first recorded games in the late 19th century in England, there was a soccer team called the British Ladies Football Club, and it was really a part of the suffragette movement. One of the women who organized it did it under a pseudonym because it was very dangerous for women to be, you know, seen really in public and seen to be trying to do the things that men were doing. And she organized a game, and, you know, the women wore shorts, which was absolutely kind of shocking and in that time, really just to prove that the women could do things and they didn't have to wear this very restrictive dress that was kind of mandatory at the time in Victorian England. And they did that, you know, they played the games and they went on tour of England, and they played against a men's team in Scotland, and got such a terrible reception that ended in a riot. The women were injured. And that was the end of that kind of beginning moment for women's soccer. And since then, there have been these incredible moments during the first.
Okay, it sounds like we have perhaps lost our distant guest. I'm going to just quickly ask, Gemma, you there? No, Gemma's not there. Okay, well, we're going to turn for some local context to KCUR sports reporter Greg Eklund, who covered professional women's soccer in Kansas City when we had a team. And he's also covered the team's departure, which happened fairly quietly in 2017. He's got a new story, and we'll hear about that shortly.
Yes, can you not hear me?
I can hear you now. Okay, Greg, it's a little teaser for what's to come. But Gemma, so can you pick up where you were leaving off? You were talking about that there have been all these incredible moments. Greg.
Good morning, Gina.
Hi. So start by, you know, for people who might have missed it, when and why did Kansas City lose its women's soccer team? We have at different points. We've
sure.
had two of them, but most recently, FCKC.
FCKC has not been around now for 2 years. It folded in the fall of 2017, so this is the second full season in which soccer is being played this summer, professional soccer, in the National Women's Soccer League, NWSL. And essentially, the bulk of the players that were in Kansas City were moved to Salt Lake. It's a 9-team league right now. The league would like to get back to 10, which is where it was at one point. And there's been just some discussion, is Kansas City viable and then for a future as, you know, to round out the 10, but, you know, that discussion is much later. But to give you the brief history, it was under a different ownership than it originated. And under the new ownership, who was an out-of-town owner, the operations were really bare-boned operations as compared to how they started out. And so there was no marketing. The crowds were down. And it just took a severe downturn from there.
So there were quite a few members of the national women's soccer team who played for FCKC.
Yeah, Becky Sauerbrunn would be the most notable. She's on the current U.S. Women's World Cup roster. And there were other national teamers. Amy Rodriguez, she's not on the World Cup roster right now, but she's still very active and playing. And she was here in Kansas City last summer when the women's team played at Children's Mercy Park an international match.
I spoke on this show with one of the players who was fairly annoyed with the lack of even local recognition for the team, considering how much they were crushing it, and then especially as compared with Sporting KC, which does very
sure.
well, but they were like crushing it.
Yeah.
Was that a common sentiment among the players?
Yeah, I think so. They won championships. They won the league championship in both 2014 and 2015. But at a time when there is less space devoted to sports in general in the Kansas City Star, it was difficult for the women's team, and justifiably so, to, you know, for them to get more space in the news sports pages than they did. They were a legitimate, solid team, as their championship caliber demonstrated. But it was a struggle for them to get publicity while they were in town.
It's interesting because what you are looking into now indicates that this is a problem bigger than just Kansas City, on the other hand. I mean, you are now looking into the size of the National Women's Soccer League with teams folding. They're supposed to have, what, a minimum of 10 teams?
Yeah, they'd like to have 10. The most recent team that folded was the Boston Breakers. So there's another major market that that folded with its team, and there's turnover constantly. So they've been trying to find stability in the women's professional soccer ranks here in this country for years and years.
How do you understand the sort of disconnect between the level of success women are achieving in this sport and the level of interest that the sports public or perhaps the sports media has, you know?
I would say because this is just my opinion. I think, in my opinion, there's too much of a comparison of the women's game to the men's game, in as opposed to taking the women's game in and of itself. This is a common problem, I think, in women's basketball, too. where if, you know, there are people out there who say, well, you know, the women's game is not as good as the men's and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, if you take the women's game in and of itself, when you see really, really good women's basketball being played, it's fun to watch. And but it's not the men's games. But and that's an unfair comparison when they're compared to the men in that regard.
Let's bring back Gemma Clark. Gemma, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, you know, how does this, what Greg is describing, fit in within the context of the history of women's soccer?
I mean, it's rife with difficulties. And I think what Greg is saying is that the coverage just isn't there, you know, and it's still struggling. I think, you know, Washington Spirit just had a huge top of the table clash and won in front of a huge crowd and went top of the NWSL, and they got a paragraph about it in the Washington.
Okay, well,
who don't give it the attention that it deserves.
Gemma, I've mentioned Brandi Chastain. I am a person who doesn't really follow any sport in great depth. I tend to know an athlete's name when it's being spoken beyond the sports world. And Brandi Chastain is one of the names that I will never forget. What are your thoughts on the victorious scene? It was a famous scene. It played over and over and over again, where she rips off her shirt and clenches her fists after scoring that World Cup winning penalty kick. She has the biggest smile on her face, and then she's just engulfed by a swarm of ecstatic teammates.
It's an incredible moment, such an iconic moment. And really, that was the culmination of years of work, not just from Brandi, but from all the players on that team and the players who've gone before them. You know, they brought the game from the grassroots to the big stage. They worked to drum up support for that World Cup and to play in the big stadiums. They fought for absolutely everything. And so to win it against, you know, just an incredible China team, with the last kick of the game, with the last penalty, and such, you know, it was absolutely sweltering that day. It was over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and the Rose Bowl was packed. You know, it was like 90,000 fans packed into the Rose Bowl. And so to win it on home soil with people watching, you know, I think they described recently, they went back and revisited that afternoon and said they were coming to the stadium in a coach, and there was so much traffic, and they suddenly realized that the traffic was there for them, that there were people actually coming to watch them. And I think then that moment she ripped off her shirt, and that, you know, was such a pure celebration. And anyone who's played sport or watches sport knows that that is just a release of tension, and the men's players do it all the time. And I think, you know, there was some sort of puritanical backlash to that, and it, in some quarters it became taken and made into something it wasn't. But, you know, she'll even say she's sort of slightly embarrassed at the fact of being, you know, tied to that memory, but also really proud. So it really is just an iconic moment and has brought so much more attention to the game than it otherwise would have got.
You tell the stories of women who made it for themselves in soccer, but also blazed trails for other women in soccer. Can you give a favorite story or two of a woman who, despite some of the perception things that are working against them and even some of the sort of structural things that are working against them, have made it their own, have made soccer their own?
There are so many stories, and it was actually hard to narrow it down to 50 profiles, because I feel like every woman who's played this sport at a senior level has blazed a trail in some form. Joy Fawcett, you know, she showed up to play an international tournament with her, I think, 2-month-old baby daughter, and was told at the accommodation she showed up to play with the national team, you know, you can't bring your baby here. And so she was like, well, what do I do? You know, I've got nowhere to go.
And luckily, she was taken in by a family who you know, gave her a place to stay so she could continue playing. And she was really, she and Carla Overbeck were two of the players who really fought to have, you know, childcare as part of the national team setup, and, you know, to have their children along, which was a huge part of changing the game and shaping it for future generations and future mothers. But as I say, there are so many stories, and these stories don't just take place in the US. There are stories from around the world. There's a player in Iran called Niloufar Ardalan, who in Iran, it's the law that a husband can prevent his wife from traveling. And her case came to light because he prevented her from traveling to a soccer tournament that took place abroad. And she fought for her right to leave, and she was granted it eventually in a following tournament. And it really shone a light on what was happening in Iran and that particular law, and actually affected some change
that gets
in Iranian
back,
parliament.
Yeah, that does get back to the original point you were making, that women's soccer and women's rights have been really intertwined internationally throughout history. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, soccer is a reflection of what's happening in a particular time in a particular region, and for women's soccer, it's a reflection of what's happening for women the world over.
You know, we were talking with Greg Eklund just a moment ago about that the Women's National Soccer League is struggling to have as many teams as they really need to stay vibrant and interesting and all of those things. That a league needs a certain number of teams in it to sustain a season of play. And so it is interesting to me at a moment when it seems like so many girls in America play this sport that there isn't a fan base even among those kids and their families for the girls who grow up to be women who play soccer at the highest level.
There is a fan base, and I think really the two things holding it back from getting more people in the stadiums, one is coverage, you know, not getting the coverage, and the other is investment. You know, there's such a lack of major investment and, you know, big names buying teams and putting money into it, and that's really what the league needs. It needs money. It needs the kind of investment the MLS has had.
Well, hold that thought. In just a minute, we're going to hear from a local trying to change how the next generation of girls and women experience life in soccer. You can call 816-235-2888 with your story. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. The Women's World Cup is underway right now. Tomorrow is the first game for the U.S. team. So now, for those gearing up to watch, we are talking about women in soccer nationally, internationally, and locally. I've been talking so far with the author of a book about the history of women's soccer and with KCUR's own sports reporter, Greg Eklund. Now I want to bring in Carrie Fry Robinson. She is the founder and director of Finesse Soccer Training Academy here in Kansas City, where girls who play soccer are coached by women who play soccer. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there.
First of all, anything you want to respond to or chime in on from the conversation that's been happening so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so true, just seeing the struggle that women have gone through culturally that we've experienced, and then bringing in the soccer level of it, that just, for me, reading Gemma's book was really eye-opening, the beginning of soccer and all the challenges we've been through to get to where we are now. And the fact is really frustrating that we still can't get the attention that we deserve as females playing a sport, oftentimes playing a lot cleaner than our male counterparts. And
cleaner not, in what way?
Well, the men's game, there's a lot of floppers.
What is that?
So if you get fouled really hard or don't even get touched in the men's game, men are pretty dramatic in this sense, and they just roll about the field. And some international stars are really well known for that. And then the women are applauded for getting hit really hard and just getting back up on our feet and keep on going. And I think there's a lot of similarities between that and kind of the roots of the women's game, is that you can't stop us, that you might try as hard as you can to to bring us down, but we're just going to get back up our feet and keep going.
What's your history with soccer?
Been playing since I was five. I grew up playing on a local recreational team with elementary school friends. Played through high school at Shawnee Mission East. Very successful there. We won 2 state championships. Got runner-up my senior year, which I still have a hard time talking about.
That is hard. It's so close.
Pretty brutal. But my senior year, I set a state record for goals in the season. I was All-American, won pretty much every honor at the local and state level. I was actually called the Darren Sproles of girls soccer.
How do you feel about being called the fill-in-the-blank of girls soccer?
Right, yeah. It's, I guess an honor in one sense because, you know, he played professionally for San Diego, I believe, for the Chargers.
He's still playing.
He's still playing, right. So it just kind of shows the disparity between where women can go with the sport and where men can go with their sport at this time. But I was also a little frustrated. Like, I am my own person, and I did this because of my hard work, and I should be.
And that you have to find a male name to find a name people recognize.
Right. Yes. Yeah, it was. I think it kind of lit a fire in me that I want to change things for girls. And so I went, I was recruited all across the country by tons of schools and decided to go to Indiana University to pursue a degree in business. And I played soccer there. The varsity team just really wasn't something that was bringing me fulfillment. So after my freshman year, I thanked my coach. He kept me on scholarship and I said, you know, this is just not for me right now. I want to pursue academics and, enjoy college as well. So I played club and had a really great opportunity to make some big changes there. And, I was among a group of 10 women who got together to formalize a club region, that's still in use today in the Big Ten. So it was really impactful, I think, as to who I am today, to take that opportunity and develop my leadership skills there.
What exactly is the Finesse Academy and why did you start it? I mean, we're, I think, hearing a lot of why you started it, but specifically, what is it that sets it apart and why?
Sure. So I started it because I'd never had a female coach until college, and I had tremendous coaches here, but I never had a female coach, and I didn't have that opportunity experience being coached by somebody who understood being a girl. And sometimes it takes a different kind of motivation to get us going, or sometimes you're just having a really bad day. And it was great having a female coach that understood that. And I'd coached club when I'd moved back from California. I'd coached some club teams and realized all my counterparts were all male. To no surprise, most of the coaches were male. And so I wanted to provide girls that had a male coach to get have an opportunity to train with a female coach while still being with their team. So we are an all-girls training academy, all-female training staff. There's 14 trainers on staff. We all played in college. Some of us played professionally, even overseas professionally. And our mission is to inspire our girls to be brave, strong, and powerful. And we're trying to take soccer beyond being the best or playing at the highest level you can, and making it about keeping girls in the game by providing a fun and encouraging environment for them to thrive.
When you say keeping girls in the game, that terminology interests me because it does seem like so many really young girls play soccer. Is there an age where you see that taper off, maybe at a different rate than you see it taper off for boys? With every sport, it tapers off because it's like the best of the best who keep going.
Right.
But do you see that happening faster with girls for one reason or another?
I think it's a good question. I think what I see that's kind of rips me apart is 10 and 11 and 12 year olds who are quitting soccer because they didn't make the top team in their age group or because they didn't make the team they wanted to, where at that point they really should just be playing for fun and for enjoyment and for exercise and for social connections. But they're getting to the point where, and our society is doing this, is making it, well, if you're not on the best team, it's not good enough. And so and a lot of parents are getting this a message that is not exactly reflective of the value of soccer. The value of soccer is learning life skills and being healthy and enjoying something and having fun and developing leadership skills and teamwork and communication.
Do you think having an all-girls environment is somehow fulfilling that part of the mission, the sort of secondary benefits of soccer?
Absolutely. You get to play with your friends and you get to meet people in a low pressure environment where if you're playing on your club team and you get cut, all of a sudden your friends are playing on the team and you're not playing anymore. And it might be hard to see them at school or might be uncomfortable. So by virtue of the fact that we're all females and we've all been there and we can really use our experiences to encourage girls to play for the fun of the game and the love of the game versus, you know, winning the championship. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm competitive as the next person and I want to win even in my women's league. I play and I still want to win every game.
Still barely talk about being runner up in high school. Let's yeah, be real.
I know. That was 2001, so it's been a long time.
It is interesting. I have a lot of nieces and nephews, and I've been watching them play soccer since they were really tiny over in Swope Park. And it's been interesting to me to see the boys and the girls start out on the same teams when they're really little, and heartening in a way, because as I watch that, I think, wow, how cool would that have been to grow up at a time when boys see the girls in sports as their teammates and rivals? Talk about like what makes you understand someone as an equal and respect them. Then they turn, I think it's maybe five or so, and they split off. And I have to admit, I feel a little hint of sadness when that happens. What do you think about that as sort of maybe like the opposite picture of the all girls environment and the all boys environment?
Yeah, so I think the fact that they're able to start on the same playing field is a wonderful thing, because girls need to see that just because I'm playing with or against a boy doesn't mean that I'm worse than. I played with boys growing up. I played with my girls' team, and then I guest played on a boys' team ages up. So I could get it is a faster game. It is more physical. So it demands more from you as a player. So having that experience was really helpful to me in my soccer career. But to put girls in an all-girl environment, I think at a young age, actually has some benefits, because they, you know, the boys are typically faster. Just genetically, that's just how we're made. So they can still compete without feeling badly that they're not as good as the boys. But I do love when I hear like second, third, fourth, fifth graders that are in our programs and they're like, we beat the boys at recess, you know, and it's just like, yes, you did, because you can do that. You know, just because they're boys doesn't mean they're better.
There's so much that can be done from inside the sport, as you're describing. Like, you're a person who's come up through the world of soccer and you're trying to change how other people come up in the world of soccer. What do you think needs to change outside the sport?
I think outside of the sport, of respect of the sport. A lot of people don't understand the sport itself, but I think a lot has to do with how parents, the information parents are fed from organizations that want their kids to participate with them. I think our country needs to take a good hard look at why our kids are playing, and that it's not a revenue model, that it really should be a model for creating better citizens and community members versus making more money off of more players in our programs.
I want to turn back to Gemma Clark, the author who we've been speaking with earlier. I wonder what your take is on that, just the difference between what needs to happen within the sport of soccer for women and men to both be able to thrive, and what needs to happen maybe outside the sport itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think Carrie makes some great points, and you know, what you have there is a great deal of participation at a young age. And I think it's about really, you know, encouraging that and getting, you know, young girls through and bringing them to professional status. And a big part of that is making sure that the league itself is, you know, thriving and that it has adequate investment. And, you know, I really would love to see, you know, there's so many wonderful commercials at the moment for the World Cup. You know, there's Nike has done this incredible commercial and there's a huge buzz about it. But I'd love to see Nike putting a lot of money into the NWSL or, you know, another massive corporate sponsor. And I think that would really raise participation and give girls something more concrete to aim for.
How do they become inspired to do that? I mean, where do you see the potential for that connection between all of what seems to be a pretty widespread support for girls in recreational soccer and translate that into support for women in professional soccer?
I think it comes down to investment and funding. I mean, just from seeing the way the game has changed in England. When I played as a young kid of like 9 or 10, I was the only girl, and there were, you know, 300 odd boys in the soccer school I went to. And it really wasn't something I could continue doing once I realized that I couldn't play in the men's leagues. You know, and now the England women's team, they are on the front pages of the newspapers there. And there is an interest, and there are, if you go to the local park, you'll see women's teams playing, which was kind of unthinkable even 10 years ago. And I think so much of that has to do with, you know, seeing players in mainstream outlets on big commercials, and seeing the leagues take off, and feeling as though that is a profession that is given its due, and that, you know, is well paid, given that it's such a short lifespan, and you're putting your body in you know, in harm's way every game. I think that is what's needed to bring the game up to speed and encourage, you know, women to play for longer periods and at professional level.
Greg Eklund, what are your thoughts about all of this, as you are just even now reporting on this issue of the Women's National League only having 9 teams?
Well, Gemma mentions investment and funding, and some of that with the NWSL has taken place by some Major League Soccer teams co-owning the women's professional soccer teams. And that has taken place just in Salt Lake, the team that has the core of the Kansas City players. And in a place like Portland, which has huge crowds for the men's game, they make it incumbent. If you want to get on the waiting list for the men's matches, you better buy tickets to the women's matches to go see them play. And then maybe then we'll consider you for a men's season ticket.
Because then we'll know you're a real fan.
Yeah, exactly. So, But it's an incentive, you know. Okay, if you want to get in, you know, you go out and see what the other product that we have. Now, the question that's raised here is since it's done in Major League Soccer and other markets like Portland, Seattle, Houston, and Salt Lake, can it be done here in Kansas City?
And is there even talk of that?
Well, there isn't any talk of that, and I think the main reason why is because Sporting Kansas City is heavily involved, one, with the Swope Park Rangers, which is essentially a minor league team that feeds into Sporting Kansas City. Two, it's heavily invested into the U.S. Training Center in Kansas City, Kansas. So I don't think Sporting is quite ready to invest on the women's side as yet, just because of the other things that it has going and is trying to keep going.
Are there murmurs of any other approaches to bringing professional soccer back to Kansas City for women, professional women's soccer?
It comes down to ownership again, and to what Gemma was referring to as investment and funding. The original owners sustained some huge losses, but they were planting a seed for something that was gradually growing. And as Gemma had said, there is a fan base. It's just being willing to take the early losses and sustaining that for that growth.
Greg Eklund, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Gemma Clark, thank you. And Carrie Fry Robinson, founder and director of Finesse Soccer Training Academy, thank you. The U.S. women's soccer team will play their first World Cup game tomorrow against Thailand at 2 p.m. Up next, police Twitter. It's a thing. Call now with your favorite police tweet from a local department, or perhaps the cringiest one. That conversation is next. Stay tuned. Do you follow any police departments on Twitter? If not, you might be surprised to hear the kind of stuff they put out there. It's not all public service announcements and warnings about dangerous situations to steer clear of. It is often lighthearted humor that might seem out of character for the police persona we tend to imagine. Lawrence's police Twitter has gotten national attention for tweets such as this gem. On April 20th, of last year. They tweeted, "Hey, potheads planning to toke up on 420. Stay off the road. Stock up on Cheetos and Mountain Dew before you spark." And then they shared news of plans to beef up patrol efforts to stop intoxicated drivers. The weird part, of course, being encouragement to stock up on munchies when getting high to begin with is technically illegal in the state. I'm Gina Kaufman, and it is a fine line to walk, tweeting for the police. So we're going to talk to the people who do it around here on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 if a police tweet has ever made you raise your eyebrows. What do you think of the whole thing? Funny or cringy? 816-235-2888. I have two people here who tweet for police departments. Sarah Boyd for the Kansas City Police Department. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
And Danny Chavez with us from the Lenexa Police Department. Hi, Danny.
Good morning.
So I'm curious what you each think of as the point of police Twitter. Danny, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, primarily, of course, the use of Twitter by police departments is to inform the public, whether it's such things as road closures, police activity. But of course, social media as a whole is a great way to engage with your community, allows them a forum to ask questions of the police department, perhaps points of law.
Is there a tone you have to strike to encourage that kind of interaction?
I think just having a reputation for somebody who is available on social media, knowing that if somebody asks you a question, that they will get a timely response. Certainly, as you pointed out, you know, we want to break character a bit to make it a little more interesting to engage. We've seen that from police departments across the country over the last few years. Kind of breaking that, that stuffy role that maybe we had come to be known as. You think about some of the fun things you've seen on social media, a mannequin challenge, running man challenge, where you have officers dancing, having fun. The use of Twitter is just a great forum to show that human side behind the badge, but also to inform the community of important information at times.
Sarah Boyd, what about you? What do you think of as the point?
I think the point is to make police accessible to the public, because normally people interact with us on a bad day. And I want people to be able to know that they can come to us anytime and that we are there to help them. So, and yes, information sharing is huge on that. But the point of Twitter in particular, I think, is to reach people with a message and to let them ask us questions and to have a conversation. It's not just us putting information out, you know, about a crime or something like that. It's definitely more of a back and forth. And it's a chance to, I think people will ask us things on Twitter that they never would walk up to a police officer and ask.
Can you give an example?
All the time. So we get every day people ask about, why did this happen in my, or what happened in my neighborhood? Why is this road closed? I need to know some information about whether I can do this. Is this legal? Things like that.
What are, can you think of something someone wanted to know if it was legal?
Oh, yeah. People want to put like red and blue lights on their cars. And they want to know about that, which is not legal, by the way, unless you're an emergency responder vehicle. They want to know about like carrying weapons and that kind of thing. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm not even a cop. But I work with them a lot. And so I wouldn't recommend turning to us for legal advice, but we can definitely guide you in the right direction.
Is there a certain line that you have to walk between making the police accessible and human and then maybe teetering off onto some other territory, like eroding the sense that police take the situations they handle seriously and sensitively?
For sure. For sure. So I love the Lawrence Police Department's Twitter. It's so fun. But we can't get away with it in our city because we speak to our audience. There's a different audience in Lawrence. And so we have to be sensitive to the people who make up Kansas City, Missouri. We use humor primarily to engage so that they're there with us when we have important information to share. And also for that accessible human factor. But we've got to be careful not to offend people. We use this humor to get our message farther because I could say, like, so every November we have we have car deer crashes. So I could just say, please look out for deer on the roads. But we put out every year the same tweet that says something like, lusty deer are abounding on area roadways and they won't let your car get in the way of their quest for lovin'. Please look for deer. That's going to get shared a lot farther, but the message is going to stay with it. Like, oh yeah, there's deer out here. I need to be cognizant of that.
All right. Danny Chavez. Yeah. I mean, what are your thoughts about this line?
Yeah. You know, I think if we step out of the social media realm for a second and just look at the public's attitude towards law enforcement in general over the last few years, the line has moved a little bit. Certainly, the public still expects police to be professional and to still get our job done. But again, I'll point to some of these trends we've seen on social media where you have officers having fun with the community, dancing, lip syncing along to silly songs. You know, 5 or 10 years ago, the public may see that and think that's not professional for the police department to be lip syncing to a song or to be dancing around acting goofy. But today, I think those are exactly the kinds of things that the public likes to see. And I think by and large, people don't see that as unprofessional. They see that as human. And so, of course, even when using humor on Twitter, we still need to be professional. But I think those lines have moved a little bit from just a few years ago. And in fact, I think people enjoy seeing that side of police, that we can still get our job done. We have a very serious job. And the public knows that we see very disturbing things day in and day out. However, we can still communicate with them and show a human side to our officers through the use of social media and having fun. So we still want to be appropriate. We still want to get the message across. We want to be seen as credible in what we're sharing, but we think we can package that in a humorous way.
Can you think of an example of a time when either you, when tweeting on behalf of the Lenexa Police Department, or someone else tweeting on behalf of another police department has perhaps gotten it wrong?
I'll give you an example from my use of Twitter, which at the time I you know, didn't think was a problem. A couple of years ago, we experienced one of these quick spring thunderstorms in the metro area, and we had a bout of hail. And so I was patrolling around, and I thought, you know, in the meteorology world, they measure hail according to things like, you know, ping pong ball or nickels or dimes. And I got to thinking, well, I want to let the public know that we had some hail in Lenexa, and you know, I needed to provide a scale for how big was the hail. And I was thinking, well, what are some things in the law enforcement world that I could relate it to? And I thought, well, this hail laying around looks like rocks of methamphetamine. And so I tweeted that we've had meth-sized hail here in Lenexa. I really didn't think much of it. I just thought, well, that's a scale we would use.
In your world.
In my world, exactly. I'm not a meteorologist.
Okay, and that maybe didn't go over great.
It didn't go over with some folks. You know, you're always going to have some things that people will enjoy, but many folks thought that I was making light of drug problems and people that may have addictions, and that certainly was not my intention at all, but it was a good learning experience that maybe I should have worded that a little differently.
Let's talk to Raul Perez. He is a sociology professor joining us from Southern California, where he has studied this whole police Twitter phenomenon. Hi, Raul.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Is Danny's misstep there sort of indicative of a larger juggling act?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I should just say something just briefly about sort of humor and what it does, kind of as a social phenomenon, and then maybe contextualize that for what's happening specifically in law enforcement. So, I mean, humor is this very sort of important social tool that we use every day to communicate with other people, to draw people in a little bit closer, right? Humor is a way in which we can give social pleasure, social joy. It's a tool that we use oftentimes to enhance, you know, collegiality, friendships, solidarity. You know, humor brings people together. So in that sense, you know, when any organization, whether it's law enforcement or even in my profession, education, teachers and instructors and professors and even administrators, sometimes, you know, we'll use humor, you know, to lighten the mood in the classroom, or, you know, when you're giving a speech to kind of break the ice a little bit, you know, to essentially what the officers are regarding as, you know, making yourself a little bit more human. So that there is something that happens, you know, across the board, not just within, you know, specific organizations. So, you know, from the point of law enforcement, it makes sense that they would use something like social media, something like Twitter specifically in this case, using humor to draw in the community, you know, to show a more human side of law enforcement and essentially to try to improve police community relations. I mean, so that right there makes a lot of sense, especially given the context of law enforcement over recent years, especially where organizations like Black Lives Matter are really spotlighting, you know, some of the police abuses that have happened around the country over the last several years. So now on the one hand, then humor use can have these positive social functions. But there are also these negative social functions for humor, right? Especially when humor is used to insult, you know, to ridicule, to mock, you know, to dehumanize. And in my own research, looking at this kind of more negative aspect of humor, and looking at the way that, for instance, within law enforcement, it's been used. You know, we can also see that while on the one hand, humor is being used to enhance collegiality, to build friendships and collegiality, et cetera. At the same time, through the use of ridicule, you can erode social unity, social harmony within organizations, and in this case, between police and community.
You know, so, Raul, can I jump in and say part sure. of any joke anyone makes, one thing that can go wrong is a mistaken sense of, like, shared assumptions. So, to get the joke, usually find a joke funny, you have mm-hmm. to share a certain basic frame of reference. And when two people, or in this case, an organization and people, don't share the same frame of reference, that can become very, very obvious when a joke just doesn't land. Can you think of an example of a joke that didn't land because whoever was tweeting on behalf of a police department sort of failed to take a certain segment of the population's experience into account?
I mean, I think in any situation where, maybe if I can simplify it, where you have two scenarios, one in which people are laughing with, meaning they're enjoying the joke together. That's different when there's a context of laughing at, or, you know, someone else being the object of the joke or the ridicule, right? So in the context where officers, for instance, are trying to have fun with the community, you know, that's different than officers having fun at the expense of the community, right? So the Plainview project, this new study, this new database that has gathered a lot of attention recently, was looking not at Twitter, but something very similar, was looking at Facebook posts by officers in over 8 police departments around the country. You know, they gathered over, you know, nearly 3,000 posts from officers in all these departments, current officers and also retired officers, you know, in cities as far as Dallas, you know, Philadelphia, Phoenix, you know, and St. Louis, all over the country. And part of what they were spotlighting was the way that officers were engaging in racial bias against particular groups, using dehumanizing language, you know, referring to people as animals, subhuman, et cetera.
But so it's maybe being used to, like, vent in inappropriate ways?
Well not
on the job or something?
Yeah, not only to vent in inappropriate ways. I mean, a lot of these were being circulated as jokes, as memes, as humor, right? But a lot of this humor was veiled in bigotry, in racism, in jokes that were at the expense of community, right? They were mocking different groups, you know, African Americans, Latinos, you know, some officers were seen celebrating Confederate flags.
So this is kind of where the danger lies for police departments getting casual about social media. And Sarah Boyd, I just would love for you to jump back in here.
what do you see as sort of your guiding philosophy to keep you from perhaps veering into that territory?
Well, I'm hoping that what Raul was referring to was personal pages of law enforcement officers and not institutional ones, because we make a really concerted effort to have one voice from the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department on social media, and to avoid the fracturing of the message. So our guiding principle is our mission statement, to protect and serve with integrity, honor, and professionalism, and that extends to our social media as well.
Sarah Boyd of the Kansas City Police Department, thank you. Danny Chavez with Lenexa Police Department, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Raul Perez, professor from California, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We are out of time, but this has been an interesting conversation. We had two discussions today, one about women in soccer and the other about police Twitter. You'll be able to find them both at kcur.org/centralstandard. Later today, this show is produced by Melody Rowell, Chris Young, Salisa Kalakal, Ann Kniggendorf, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.